How would you like to buy your home overseas? Mike Cobb will tell us how, and what's so special about Mike is he's the visionary co-founder and CEO of ECI Development, and he's a leading force in international real estate. And since 1996, the company has amassed over 4,000 acres and 5 miles of beachfront real estate across Belize, Nicaragua, Panama, Costa Rica, and now expanding into El Salvador, Argentina, Chile, Ecuador. And they create dynamic residential communities across the region, offering private villas in an oceanfront golf resort. And he has a new book, How to Buy Your Home Overseas. And my co-founded K International Bank, revolutionizing mortgage services in Belize and throughout the region. And he sits on the board of several multinational corporations, as well as the board of Champions for Global Glimpse of Significant Impact. And he's a sought-after speaker. Now, tell me about buying your home overseas. What inspired you to buy a property overseas in the first place? Because I'm a property investor myself, and I find that it's easier to invest in something that's relatively local, generally. Mm-hmm. So what's your reasoning for choosing something that's abroad?
Property Wealth Strategies podcast with Lily Patrashko shares world's most influential property investors, sharing their strategies for making money with property.
Well, great question, Lily. Thanks for having me today. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And you know, the real easy answer is my very first property I purchased overseas was 33 years ago. I bought a condo in Belize. And really, I bought it because, you know, I owned a home in the United States at the time. And I thought, you know what, I want to be in vacation properties because I understood the rental potential. And this is long before Airbnb and VRBO. And so literally, I bought a condo and I had an ad in the back of the Washington Post newspaper, a physical newspaper. And there was an ad in the back that said, rent my condo, $800 a week. And literally, I would mail people the keys in an envelope. I would mail the keys to the condo. They would fly down. They would, right? So it was like before Airbnb. And for me, it was diversification. To answer the question simply, I wanted international diversification. I already owned a home in the U.S. I was looking at some other properties in other parts of the United States outside my home state. But the idea of having a property overseas that was truly globally diversified was what really captured my imagination. And the fact that it was a vacation property that I could use, I don't know, 4 or 5 times a year when I went down for fun, and then rent it out other times to vacation owners, that was really the bottom line. Diversification, but into a rental property, a vacation rental property.
Thank you. Tell me why buying a home overseas is a better option than investing locally in the U.S.
Well, you know, Lily, I don't think it is a better option, actually. I am a big fan of investing locally. I own real estate in and around where I live today, other places in the United States as well. So I'm a big advocate of buying properties and property investments locally because we can keep our eye on them. Like if there's something, if we like to do it ourselves, we can go do things ourselves, right? Or we can outsource it to a management company, but we're still there to be the eyes on the management company, right? We can see it. So there are a ton of benefits of investing in property locally. So I don't believe actually that owning a property overseas is better than owning a property locally. What really foundationally absolutely do believe is that we should never have all of our eggs in one basket. And when we have all of our investments, and we think about stocks, right? I think you're in Britain, aren't you in England, Lily? Right. So, you know, so for folks in your audience who are in England, right, if you own properties in England, but you for investment properties, you have stocks that are on the AIM exchange, for example, right? So now all of a sudden you've got all of your investments, your money presumably is in a British bank, right? And so now all of a sudden you have all of your eggs in a basket called England, right? It's a great basket. I would never bet against it, right? Just like I personally would never bet against the United States. I have a lot of eggs in the basket called the United States of America. But I think the prudent and wise investment decision that we should all make is, okay, let's take 5%, 10%, 20%. I don't know, pick a number, but somewhere in that, you know, maybe 5 to 20% range of our investable net worth, and move it outside our home country basket, because there's just real prudence in doing that. So I wouldn't say it's better. I think it's necessary. Maybe that's the right word. I think it's necessary once you have a sufficient local domestic portfolio of investment properties to then diversify something globally, something outside our home countries.
Thank you. What's the best way to choose home overseas that ends up in a way satisfying both of your needs, which is to make it a great vacation home and to make the great rental potential long term? And you can say a third one being making it a relatively safe investment where you're not just, you know, enjoying it for your own personal benefit of, you know, going there, but also it's a safe investment in terms of, like, perhaps, I don't know, the culture and the political environment, the economic environment, I don't know, some other criteria that you will tell us about. Sure. So that overall it is a safe investment for you as a U.S. Right. investor.
Yeah, well, and so safe, I think, means many different things, right? It can mean physical safety, it can mean financial safety, it can mean legal safety, right? And so let me touch on those. I think crime is almost always local. I mean, you could say London's a very dangerous city, you could say London's a very safe city. Just depends on where in London you are. Same thing with any city, right? So any country, right, has safe areas and dangerous areas. So the safety aspect is one aspect of safe, like the physical safety, right? And so I think we want to locate our properties in areas that are that give us a high measure of physical safety, right? And tourism areas are generally like that. I mean, the countries themselves understand that tourism for a country that has the Caribbean, for example, or Central America, tourism's huge. And so the countries understand the importance of keeping those areas safe for tourists. And generally they do a very, very good job. So I think location for physical safety is important because your guest, your renter, will also be looking for that. And if they have it, if they find it, then they're going to feel very comfortable, maybe repeat visit, give you high stars on your rankings. So I think those are very important. Financial stability is the next one. Well, actually, let me come back to financial stability. Let me start with legal. The thing that's paramount, and I would say foundational, in any and every foreign investment I've ever made, and any foreign investment that I would ever recommend, is that the country must treat foreigners the same way it treats locals, vis-a-vis the law, property rights, right? And so a country that says we're going to treat locals this way, but if you're a foreigner, there's a different set of rules. Like, I don't like that. I think that's a dangerous situation legally. And so we only work in countries where foreigners and locals are treated constitutionally the same. I think that's a very strong legal foundation that should never be, you know, never be skimped on. The other thing is title, right? We need to understand what the title is. Is there fee simple title? And that's an English word. Escritura publica is a civil law version of fee simple title. So again, on the legal basis, those would be the two. Then you have financial, right? I think countries that have a strong financial basis, right, allow for financial stability. And that prevents things like political instability. When you have financial stability, then you have a lot more political stability. So again, these things all hang together. So when I look at countries to make investments in, and they are the countries that we're invested in, Belize, Costa Rica, Panama, all three of those countries absolutely unequivocally meet each one of those qualifications. Now, to answer what floats your boat from a vacation standpoint, what do you like to do? Do you like to surf? Well, you probably want to be in Costa Rica or Panama because you want to be on the Pacific Ocean. If you like to dive or you like to snorkel, then you probably want to be in Belize or a Caribbean country, right? And so how you locate yourself based on your preferences kind of can follow. But foundationally, I think those things are really important and they're non-negotiable, right? You do those kind of safety, legal, financial, political things, you foundation, then where you locate, as long as those are in place, can be really a great enjoyment factor, but can also be a great return factor. And we can talk more about how I would pick a country or an area of a country for return, because that's maybe even a different question.
Yes, let's talk about that, like how you would pick a country. Because the thing I'm noticing is, for example, Belize in Costa Rica and so on, they're all within relatively easy reach. Like, is there like a direct flight from the US, for example? Is that another way to choose a country to invest in? And if it isn't, tell us what is the criteria for choosing the right country to invest in as a home overseas?
Sure. So I think when we look at home, home is a heart decision, right? Home is a place that I love to be. It's a place where I like my neighbors. I like the bar down the street. I like the restaurant that I can go. The grocery store is close by. That's a heart decision, right? Investment's a head decision. Investments, do the numbers add up? And we're going to talk about some of the head factors. The perfect alignment, by the way, is when the head factors, which we'll talk about in a second, align with the heart factors. When you get that kind of an alignment, then you've got something really re wonderful, powerful, and I would even use the word magical. But on the head factors, you mentioned airlift. Lily, airlift. People have to be able to get there, right? Unless you're looking for long-term rentals, that's different, right? But I'm really talking in the world of vacation rentals, right? So airlift, critically important, right? How many flights are coming? And so is it easy to get there? And do the discount carriers come? Or is it just the expensive big name, United, American, kind of, the big names? Or are the discount carriers coming? Or are the charter carriers coming, right? Because a lot of times you have the charter companies. And so that's an absolute factor for, is there business, right? But the other side of it is watching a country over years, and you can do this now historically, you don't have to have watched it. I have watched all the countries of Central America grow over the last 33 years since I bought my very first condo in Belize. And so I've watched this dynamic in action over 3 decades. And what I would say is the best time to buy a property in a country overseas is when it's in the sweet spot of the ascendant curve. And what I mean by that is countries go from being nobody's heard of it, kind of really off the radar screen, off the beaten path. They kind of come into up and coming, like, ooh, I've kind of heard about that, but I haven't been there yet. It's on my list, to the sweet spot, which is, yeah, we stopped on a cruise ship, or my brother-in-law just got back from there, right? Now it's in the popular culture. And once it's past the sweet spot, it really moves into a mature destination. And when something's mature, it'll cash flow pretty predictably because airlift is high. You got consistency. The problem is as it goes from obscurity to popular, right, the price of that asset goes up. You're going to pay more for something in a popular destination than you are in someplace obscure. And somewhere in the middle, you've got this sweet zone, this sweet spot where it's popular enough that people are going there, but the prices really haven't caught up with the popularity. And that's what I look for when I'm looking for an investment property overseas. And I'll just say that, 15 or 20 years ago, Costa Rica was in this sweet spot. Now it's in a mature spot, right? Maybe 10 years ago, Panama was kind of in this sweet spot, and now it's moved into, sort of mature. It's not totally mature, but it's certainly out of the sweet spot. A country like Belize actually right now is in the sweet spot. And then a country like El Salvador is maybe the next one coming into the sweet spot, maybe over the next 2, 3, 4 years. And so you just watch these countries kind of move through this sweet spot. And again, I've watched them over 3 decades now. And so when you're a property investor, a real estate investor, you want to catch a country in the sweet spot. You don't want to catch it way down here because you don't know when and how long. And if you want predictable cash flow and you don't care about the yield, like I'm okay getting 6%, 7%, 8%, great. Buy it up here. You're going to pay a lot more for it, but you're going to get a pretty consistent 6, 7, 8%. If you buy something in the sweet spot, you might get 6, 7, 8% for the first year or two, but as it starts to mature, the occupancies go up, the average daily rates go up, and all of a sudden, within, say, 3 to 5 years, you're starting to push into very nice double-digit returns because you bought it here and your price is fixed, right? So your yield on future cash flow goes way up as it becomes more popular. So that sweet spot is really where you want to be as a foreign property investor.
Thank you. Did you find that in certain cases, there are still properties that are in the sweet spot in terms of price because of potentially the location that is not yet super popular, but it can become in a very short space of time? And let's say the country itself has gone to a mature sort of place in terms of like generally the investment scenario. And perhaps you can still invest in that country in a certain location that is not yet in that super expensive kind of like area. And if so, what would be the best way for an investor to find those kind of like sweet spot locations to invest in?
Lily, that may have been the most insightful question I have received in a long time. Well done, well asked, well thought out. That is a brilliant question. The answer is that yes, every country, even a mature country, has areas of the country that have not really gone through the sweet spot, or maybe they're in the sweet spot or whatever, or they're pre-sweet spot, right? And so yes, absolutely. And the second part of your question is, how do you find them? You can do several things. I think book research is great. Book research, but internet, online research, talking to people, whatever, networking, right? All of that's critically important. My absolute real answer is you've got to go spend time, right? Because there's a lot of hype, right? And people hype stuff all the time, right? Ah, the next big thing. This is it. This is that. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But my belief is if you're really doing the kind of research that you want to do, and you're going to make an investment of several hundred thousand dollars or several hundred thousand pounds, right? That's a real investment. That's real money, right? And so wouldn't it make sense to go rent a place in Panama, for example, or Costa Rica for a month, 30 days, 60 days, right? Oh, and you're going to spend $1,500 a month for 2 months. Oh, it's 3 grand plus your airfare, right? I mean, so let's say it's $5,000, right? No matter where you live, you still got to eat. So food's food, right? So the only differential is rent and airfare. So you spend three, four, 5,000 bucks, you go live somewhere for a month or two. At the end of that time period, you will know with your own eyes, your own experience, your own phenomenon, right, of being able to experience it viscerally, you will know. And when you mesh that up with what you hear about on the internet, you read, you talk to people, is this the next big up and coming thing? And you're like, yeah, it could be, except the trash, I mean, like this is real, except the trash dump is half a mile away, and when the winds blow this, the winds blow the smell of the trash dump, like no, it might look like it's on the beach or whatever, it looks like it could be the next big thing, but there's a trash dump a half a mile away. The only way you ever know that is to be there, right? And so if you're really going to make investments of hundreds of thousands of dollars or pounds, it's wise to spend 30 days on the ground and then identify those areas in a country that might still be, coming up and into the sweet spot.
Thank you. Did you find that the buying a home overseas appeals most to digital nomads, or is it to wealthy families that like to occasionally travel to glamorous places?
Yeah. The answer is yes. I mean, it's both, right? It's both, Lily. I think in the past it's been more the wealthier set that are looking for a second property, a vacation property. But what's interesting is many of the very wealthy people never rent their properties. Like they own them and they only visit, maybe a few times a year, but they actually don't rent them. The folks that are more of the, maybe I would call them upper middle class, right? So they have it, it's theirs, they rent it when they're not there. So I think that's really been maybe in the last 20, 25 years, the new demographic of buyers. You have a lot of retirees. That was the leading wave in Central America and the Caribbean, really, were retirees. It was people who said, you know what, I'm going to move to nicer weather, tropical weather, lower cost of living. And so they would move to Latin America or the Caribbean because they could get those things affordably. The new demographic, which you touched on, the digital nomad, right? This demographic absolutely is the new demographic, whether it's millennials, the Gen Zs coming through, right? That they are looking at properties, not so much to buy, because they don't really have the money to buy them yet. They're still kind of early in their careers, maybe mid-career, but they don't have the extra money usually to buy. What they do is rent. And so What it does, Lily, is it offers the opportunity for real estate investors who are maybe baby boomers or Gen X, have disposable investment income to own properties in locations that are very attractive to a millennial or a Gen Z who want to rent for 3 months, 6 months, because that's what they do. They rent for 3 months and they go someplace else, right? They're touring the world, so to speak, or 6 months, whatever the period is, right? But they're doing it in these cool places. And so what you want, if you're looking to target that market, is you want properties that offer the things that are important to them. Maybe it's yoga, it's great restaurants, it's bars, it's nightlife. You want to be in a place that allows them to come and plug into the local scene, whatever that local scene is, authentically. And that's the key, right? They don't want a construct. They don't want to come to, a gated community, for example, with a bunch of old people, right? They want to be where they can authentically plug in to that country or that region of a country. And they're still going to work all day or whenever they work, right? They're going to do that remotely, but then they're going to go be. And so, if we're looking for real estate investments that appeal to that demographic, we need to be looking slightly different than if we're looking for what I would call a traditional vacation renter. I'm on vacation. Like, I want to be where it's fun and I want the golf course and right? I don't care about getting local, so to speak, because I'm only there for a week. I'm just having fun on my holiday. But the digital nomad renter is a very different renter, but I also believe a very strong rental market. And we're seeing it. I don't just believe it. We're seeing it. I mean, we serve it. And it's growing, and it's going to continue to grow as more and more of these people realize and that they really can work from anywhere. A lot of them already get it, but that number of people who are quote unquote getting it is getting bigger all the time.
Thank you. Tell us about the financial aspect of investing in a home overseas. Is it strong enough so that someone would want to invest in Belize or Costa Rica or these other places that you mentioned? You mentioned some numbers earlier. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. I think that the fundamental piece of this is if it's a diversification play, absolutely. Right. You're going to see the kinds of returns anywhere from, mid single digits, 5 to 10% kind of number into the low doubles. Right. I think right out of the gates, if somebody's talking about right out of the gates, ROIs that are, north of 10%, I would be a little bit skeptical. Right. I would say, well, that's hard to get in your first year. Right. Now, if you're buying a resale, and they can show you, well, here's my rental reports for the last 5 years. And, they got, 10.6% last year. Well, okay. I mean, it is what it is, right? But I think that placing yourself into a position where you're going to see capital appreciation is really important, right? And so there's cash on cash, right? I paid $200,000 for this condo. I made, $16,000. So that's at an 8% return. I got an 8% return kind of net, right? But then there's also, what's my condo worth in 5 years? Is it worth 250 or 300, right? And so I think that this idea of capital appreciation also plays in. It's never something that we put into any of our figures because it's just hard to know, right? You can't predict that. But I think in the developing world and in a developing tourism destination, capital appreciation can be a major factor. You just don't know what it is on the front end.
Thank you. Tell us about how can someone find the best deals to invest in a home overseas and how you personally can help with that.
Yeah, look, I think there are a couple things. One, I wrote my book, How to Buy Your Home Overseas and Get It Right the First Time. Friction costs are very expensive. So my first answer is get it right the first time. Get it right the first time, because if you buy something and you don't like it, you buy something, it's not right. You buy something and there's bad title. I mean, there's lots of things you can kind of do wrong when you go overseas because it's not your home country. You don't know the rules of the game, right? You might think you know the rules, but you don't. And so getting it right the first time is really important, because if you have to get out of it, you buy it, you pay commissions, taxes, transfer taxes, or lots of things, and then you have to sell it, right? You have to do all that stuff again. And so it can be very expensive. So the single most important thing you can do is get it right the first time. And the way you do that is through great due diligence, right? You do due diligence. You go slow. You get a lawyer, not the developer's lawyer. Never use my lawyer. Like when somebody says, oh, Mike, can we use your lawyer? I'm like, yeah, you can, but you shouldn't. Please don't. I tell people that. Go get your own lawyer, right? Like, you know, and so so get your own lawyer. Maybe hire your own engineer, right? I mean, hire an engineer to do an engineering. Like they don't have, like in the United States, we have home inspectors. Like before you buy a house, you have a home inspector who works for you, the buyer, come and look at the house and tell you everything that's wrong with it, right? And then you go back to the seller and you say, we need to fix all these things or give me a discount, whatever it is, right? So those things don't exist. So you might want to hire an engineer if you're buying a home, for example. You know, you want to look at things like the homeowners association. Who collects the money? Who spends the money? Who controls the money, right? So if you're paying, you know, whatever, $250, $300 a month to a homeowners association, where's that money going? Is it really being saved so that when the street needs repaired or whatever it is, right, there's money there to fix it, right? And so, you know, in my book, I talk about 30 things that we should absolutely be thinking about before we buy a property overseas so that we get it right the first time. And then the last thing I would say, and I've said it once and I'll just echo it here, is rent before you buy. Rent. If you really want to know the best deal in a country or part of a country or a neighborhood even, right? Rent for 6 months, 3 months, rent for 3 months, right? If you just want to do a quickie due diligence, right? A month is fine. You won't find the best deal in a month. You'll find really good deals. I think you'll know whether you like it or not in a month, but I'm not sure you'll find the best deals. If you rent somewhere for 3 months, you will absolutely find the best deals. You'll also know if you like it or not, and it'll let you go slow so that you can do all of the due diligence that give you the foundation to get it right the first time.
Thank you. Tell us, what are the worst mistakes you've seen people do when it came to buying their home overseas? Whether you've personally encountered those kind of people or you read about them in the paper.
Well, sadly, in 30 years of doing this, I've met a lot of them. I remember a guy who sent me a note, and he was so sure that he was doing everything right, and he started talking about paying incentive fees, and I thought, wait a minute, you're the buyer. Why are you? And basically, he was saying he was bribing. By the way, never bribe. It's in my book. The first time you pay a bribe, I suggest you just go to the tattoo parlor and have a big dollar sign just or a big pound sign put on your forehead, right? Because now everybody knows you pay and they're just going to hold you up until you pay. So like bribery is just wrong for so many reasons, but practically it just doesn't work either, right? And so like this guy rushed into things. He ended up paying a lot of money as a buyer, which I don't understand why you would ever do. But then in hindsight, I actually did find out what happened. Like he was basically trying to buy a property that was like too good to be true. There was a story about this, a story about that, and it ended up the title was no good. There were like, it was a bad deal. Had he gone slow, right, hired a lawyer, his own lawyer, not the one from the seller, right, maybe even hired an engineer to do a survey, like a topographical survey, right, to make sure that the property really was what he thought it was, right, just some basic due diligence would have red flags would have gone up, just red flags like, oh my gosh, you know, no, stop. So slow down, best thing you could ever do. And I have two sayings. We don't know what we don't know, right? We don't know what we don't know, but we also have to forget what we think we know, right? The assumptions, like I know what's going on. No, you don't. Just trust me. No, you don't. And so if you take the two things about we don't know what we don't know, forget what we think we know, and we put them together, they synthesize into one word, and that word is humility. Humility. If we slow down and we're humble, we ask lots of questions. We ask really stupid questions because we're the dumbest person in the whole world, right? We don't know anything about this. Ask every question that comes to mind, right? And we hire experts that represent us. If we do those things, we really can get it right the first time, Lily. And then we're going to have this tremendous experience, and we're probably going to get a really good investment. I mean, investment involves risk. It involves future. Like, you know, who knows the future, right? But I think in almost every case, we can do that. Yeah, there's some doozies out there, people that bought property that belonged to somebody else, houses that collapsed. I mean, just on and on and on. There are a ton of horror stories out there, but really they can almost all be rectified with just a humble attitude and hiring professionals to represent you in the transaction.
Thank you. How can someone leverage buying a home overseas as a path to residency?
Ah, tremendous question. Yeah, many countries offer a path to residency through real estate purchase, right? And so Belize, it's $250,000 US. And if you make a real estate investment of that or more, you qualify for their investor residency, which is a five-year residency. At the end of 5 years, you can actually apply for citizenship. And so it's a path to citizenship. A country like Panama, you know, we work with a fellow there who has taken it's a teak plantation, right? We have been farming teak for 27 years now, hundreds and hundreds of hectares of teak in Panama and Nicaragua, but in this case, Panama. And so we've been able to pair up ownership of teak with a permanent residency in Panama. And those are a lot less expensive, about $26,000. It's probably the least expensive way to get a permanent residency in Panama or anywhere, maybe even anywhere in the world as an investor residency. And so Nevis is a great example. Nevis, we don't work there, but Nevis has a passport program. So you can literally make a $400,000 investment in real estate or more, and you become a citizen of Nevis and you qualify for a passport. And so different countries offer different things. Different countries are better for certain individuals and certain requirements, right? So you can kind of shop to see what fits you best. But if you're looking just for a second residency on the investor side, Panama is absolutely the fastest, the easiest. It's also the easiest to maintain because once you have it, you only have to visit the country once every 2 years to maintain it. So a lot of the residency requirements require you to be in country, you know, 6 months out of the year, and that might or might not work for you. But Panama is very, very flexible. And then the last thing I would say is if you're a retiree, you know, and you're looking for almost no cost, maybe $2,000-$3,000 or whatever for legal fees, you can get a retiree visa. Those usually do have requirements of time in country. Digital nomad visas, those are becoming more and more popular now, where you can go and apply to live in the country for a year or two. You can work remotely. You can't take a job in the country, but you can do your digital nomad work, and it gives you the right to live in a country for, you know, 1 or 2 years. So the countries are pretty smart about this to see, but specifically on real estate investment, that'd be a great question to reach out and in our case, have one of our property and residency consultants ask you a lot of questions. What are you hoping to gain? How much time? Are there any other considerations? Are you trying to bring family members in? Right? Because all of these things would factor into which country might be the best fit. So residencies tend to be a very personal kind of discussion as opposed to more of a blanket, like, yeah, just do this. So I hope that was helpful. I know I kind of wandered a little bit, but residency is so specific to the individual that it's hard to answer generally.
Thank you. What can property investors in homes overseas do to safeguard their investment from political regime changes or other issues that may occur that you perhaps haven't thought about? And I'm not talking just politically. I'm talking about anything, like any other considerations that nobody's thinking about generally protect their investment.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is buy insurance. right? In the local environment, right? A lot of people just simply don't get insurance, right? They buy a house and they think, well, I got my house in Belize or Costa Rica, and they don't buy insurance. And then whatever, flood, earthquake, fire, whatever, right? So buy insurance. I mean, like, that's just so easy and basic. But I would say that probably more than half the people who own property overseas don't have insurance, which I don't get. But anyway, that's just what it is. The second thing I would say is get a residency. If you're going to spend time there, get a legal, legitimate residency. Do that. Do the process, whether it's retiree, digital nomad, investment visa, so that you have the right to be there, legal right to be there, right? Because if you just own a property in another country, but you're not a resident, and you can come down for a week or two or 30 days on your tourist visa, like, that's great. But what if you want to stay for 6 months? Like, you don't have the permission to do that. You don't have the legal right to do that. So insurance and residency, I would say, are two huge things that people need to do. One more thing I would just throw out there, and it has nothing to do with you, but it has to do with your heirs, especially in a civil law country. Look, you're in England, I live in the United States. We're so used to common law. Oh, we have a document. It's great. Everyone has agreed to it, right? But in Central and South America, and in much of civil law Europe, France, for example, Italy, Spain, Portugal, right? If you don't have a will in Portuguese, in Spanish, in Italian, in that country, authenticated, apostilled, right? Your heirs may have a very challenging, horrible time to claim the property that you bought. And so I think that even though you're dead and gone, right, I think that protecting the asset for your future heirs, right, is really important. So insurance, residency, will, I would say those are the big ones. But then, to answer your question sort of at a big picture, Lily, it all comes back to get it right the first time. You want to pick a country that has strong economics. You want to pick a country that has strong rule of law, right? And consistency over long periods of time, right? It's not just like they have strong rule of law, but they have a history of decades or centuries of this heritage of rule of law, right? So you want strong economy, you want rule of law, and you want pedigree. I think that's the right word, pedigree of those things as well. And when you have that, again, it's risky. You're buying, but let me just say that, we work in Central America and the Caribbean. We bought a property in Portugal as a company, and we bought it for the Portuguese Golden Visa because we were going to develop the property right next. We bought a beautiful old bed and breakfast, 350-year-old bed and breakfast in the Azores. It's spectacular. And there was a lot next to it. We bought the bed and breakfast, the lot next to it, because we were going to build residences that would qualify for the Portuguese Golden Visa. Well, then they changed the law. And like all of a sudden, like there was no Golden Visa. So we divested of that property, right? But a lot of times people ask me about political risk. Oh, you work in Central America, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, but you know where we got hammered with political risk? Portugal. So I don't know. Yeah, whatever.
Thank you. Tell us about bureaucracy and handling bureaucracy, because I think there are some countries where bureaucracy is a nightmare and others where everything is like seamless and easy to manage. Which countries did you get a really great experience with in terms of not having the mañana syndrome of like everything seems to happen tomorrow, 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 kind of that ends up never happening? And which countries did you get a great experience with where everything was happening as planned?
Wow, Lily, can I pick on you just for a second? Yes. I would love to know what country the bureaucracy just does paperwork, no fuss, no muss. If you know one, you please tell me, because I haven't found it yet.
England is but, not so bad.
Yeah, well, you know, okay, yeah, you're right. England, United States, you're right. It's not so bad. But, you know, I think that here's what I've found. I've found that when you do the procedure the correct way, right? You, whatever it says, you need these 15 documents, you need this one apostille, this one notarized, this one six copies, whatever it is, follow that whole process, right? That's first. Second, hire a lawyer. Always hire a lawyer. If you're dealing with a government agency, hire a lawyer. And hire not the big city lawyer, the big name lawyer, hire the lawyer who works in that agency, whether it's environmental, construction, title documents. I mean, there's lots of different areas, right? And so we have numerous attorneys based, depending on what we're trying to do. But the baseline is always have an attorney do it. And I'm going to give you one hack that people just shake their head and go, that's crazy, until they try it. And they're like, damn, that was great, Cobb. You know, outside, to get a residency, right, you can do all the paperwork. You can hire a lawyer to do the paperwork. But literally, right outside almost every residency, foreign national residency office in Latin America, you'll find a group of lawyers who are kind of street lawyers. Like, they might set up a little, you know, shop, or in some cases they just have a tarp, right? They just have a tarp and a computer and a printer. And like, you hire those guys because they have lunch with, yes, no, yeah, Lily, I see you're laughing, but like, that's it. Those people are the people who will get your stuff done. And so I'm a big advocate of paying for advocates for you, right? And they're service providers, right? That's what they do. They make their living providing a service. So I think, you know, some countries are maybe harder than others, but if you do all the paperwork, you don't ask for any favors, you come in with everything perfect as they ask for it, then you hire an advocate to be your representative in that agency, things generally move okay. The bureaucracy can definitely be thick. Things can kind of get, you know, pushed back, but there's where your advocate comes to play. Say, hey, look, I know you got a lot of stuff on your plate this week, but is there any way you can move Mr. Cobb's stuff up to the top? Because, you know, he's a great guy and we'd really like to help him, you know, get this building permit because he's going to hire 30 people to come build it, right? It's going to be great for your neighbor and blah, blah, blah. So like, those are the, and by the way, there was a great American politician who was the Speaker of the House when President Reagan was the president. This is going back to the 80s. His name was Tip O'Neill. And Tip O'Neill was from Boston, or from Massachusetts, but Boston specifically. And his statement is so true. It was true then. It's true today. I think it'll be true forever. All politics is local. All politics is local. And so when you're trying to get a building permit or an environmental permit, you hire somebody whose family will benefit from the jobs that you will create when you start building a condo building or building a house or whatever it is you're doing, right? So you hire somebody whose community, not just their family, but the community that they live in, will benefit as soon as you get to start working. And that tends to push things towards the front because, you know, like, hey, you know, these guys, they're going to be good for our neighborhood. They're going to create jobs. They're going to pay taxes, you know. And the other thing that we've done as an organization is we do a ton of corporate social responsibility. Like, we don't pay the mayor. We've never paid the mayor a bribe. We never bought him a pickup truck. He asked me to buy him a pickup truck once. I said, sorry, can't do it. I said, but oh, by the way, you know, I understand that you have a new clinic that's opening. Do you all have an ambulance for the clinic? And he said, no. I said, well, how about this? I can't buy you a pickup truck, but I can buy an ambulance for your clinic. How's that sound? And he's like, that's great. And then when the ambulance came, he was there with all the, you know, people in the community and whatever, and he got the credit. He got the credit for delivering an ambulance to his community. And so, you know, when there's a holdup on a permit or something, we can call the mayor. Well, he's gone, but that was many years ago. But you can call the mayor and say, hey, look, you know, we're good folks. We do lots of great things. We're kind of getting held up over here. Any way you can make a couple calls and just see if you can keep it moving along. I'm not asking for a favor. I'm just saying, like, just have them put it back in the process so it comes out the other end. And those kinds of relationships are meaningful, and they work, Lily. They absolutely work because they're true, authentic relationships in the community.
Thank you. Tell us more about building a superpower team that can help you on your goals of investing in homes abroad. And I find it a tiny bit funny that you said, you know, no bribes as a rule, because, you know, if you were to try to invest in Romania, I'm not sure how far you'd go without a bribe, because everything kind of tends to happen with a little bribe, you know, like even if you were to like see the doctor or have your kids go to school, you have to have the bribe ready. Otherwise, not a lot, or you would be put at the back of the queue.
Right. Well, I think that's true, Lily. That is a fact of life many places. And I'm not sure that our company could work in Romania. That's probably the truth. I'm not sure our company could, because, you know, we can't do that, right? And we don't do that. But I also think that you know, on the front end, it can be difficult. And I can assure you that there have been times when we first entered a country or a neighborhood in a country to work on a project, everyone didn't believe that we were going to They didn't believe we were going to pay our taxes. They didn't believe we were going to hire local. They didn't believe that we were going to do corporate social responsibility. And so we had to kind of earn it. And it took time. And so that trust based on real experience was there, right? Because talk is cheap. You know, actions, you know, speak very, very loudly. And so I think that it can go kind of slow at the beginning. But once people see that and understand, it's changed. But again, there probably are places where we couldn't work because we can't do that, right? To answer your question about team, really simple, Lily, so simple, right? If you're talking about me and my company, like how do we do it? We hire people who care, right? We hire people who care. And our interview process is largely, I mean, qualifications, right? If you're looking for an accountant, they have to have accountant, they have to have the, you know, they have to know Excel or QuickBooks or whatever it is you're doing, right? They have to have the qualifications. But lots of people, presumably most people who apply for a job, have the qualifications, and you can test that to make sure that they are competent in their qualifications. But the thing that we hire is, we call it character, right? We hire character, but what we're really hiring is care. Does the person care? Because if they care, then everything is possible, right? Everything works. And so from an internal team perspective, you know, caring is critically important. If you're a property investor and you're not really building a team, right? You're just going overseas to buy property. Well, you still are kind of building a team, right? You interview a couple, a couple engineers, you interview a couple lawyers, maybe a couple architects, whatever it is. Hire the ones that you can tell care. Right. If you do that, you're going to be far better off than picking the big name, for example, or something like that. So care.
Thank you. Tell us, what else are we missing in terms of buying a home abroad? What else is important?
Wow. We've covered a lot, Lily. You've asked some great questions that I think have really dug into the various aspects of it that are important. I think the most important thing people can do when they're looking at a property overseas is simply to do it, right? We can get into a state of analysis to paralysis where, you know, we're just going to keep looking. We can't quite get enough information. I mean, there is no such thing as all the facts. There is no such thing, right? There can always be more information, more data, right? More facts that we can add to the equation. I think a lot of people kind of get stuck there, right? Because it is scary. Let me just say it. It is scary when we think about buying a property outside our home country. But I would challenge people to think very logically and very rationally and just say, is it more scary to not do it or to have all of your eggs in one basket, right? If all of your eggs in one basket, to me, that's really scary because, I mean, like, that, it's just not, there's no prudence in that, right? And so I think we have to get over some of the fear. And the example I use is things that feel scary may or may not be scary. So for example, I've written many articles over the years, and this is one of my favorites. I kind of refresh it and send it out a lot. And in the article, I talk about, you know, risk versus the perception of risk. And the example I use is you've got somebody who's so afraid of flying. They are petrified of flying. But on the way to the airport, they're driving, you know, whatever, 130 kilometers an hour down the expressway, and they're texting while they're driving, okay? And like, they're okay with that. But when they get on the airplane, they're like, ah! But we all know that flying, just flying, is like hundreds of times more safe than driving from a logical standpoint. And we know, therefore, texting while we're driving, that's probably, you know, maybe thousands of times more dangerous than flying. But it doesn't feel that way, right? It doesn't feel that way, right? And there are reasons for that. I mean, then my article kind of goes into the brain and the neurology of why people feel that way, because it's kind of fascinating to me. But anyway, but the bottom line is this, that we may feel fear of investing overseas. And we may think that it's more, we perceive a lot more danger than there really is. And if we do our due diligence, if we do it right, we go slow, you know, we're humble, right? If we do all of those things, we can make investments overseas that are as safe as an investment in our home country. Absolutely, as safe as our home country, with the added benefit of being diversified outside our home country, which if you layer diversification into the equation, might actually make the overall portfolio even safer, right? Not that single investment, but the overall portfolio of the entire property portfolio safer because of the diversification.
Thank you. How can a property investor get a mortgage on a home overseas? Is it complicated? Is it possible?
It is possible. And full disclosure, I helped start a mortgage company in Belize back in 1994. We turned it into a bank in 2003. So our bank in Belize, Key International Bank, is now 23 years old. And I'm still on the board of directors and I'm on the management committee. So I say that as a full disclosure. Our bank offers mortgages to Europeans, North Americans buying property in Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. And typically it's pretty straightforward. It's pretty fast. We do a 50% loan to value. The client has to put up half the money. The bank puts up the other half of the money, and it's a pretty straightforward, easy process for a North American European to get a mortgage on a property in again Latin America and the Caribbean.
Thank you. And are the mortgages for buying homes overseas, are they based on the wages or the income from the companies that they have, or is it based on the merit of the investment they will be making only in terms of rental potential?
Yeah. So the bank does look at the ability to repay. Right. So we look at that, whether it's tax returns or business tax returns. And we have a loan officer who collects all the information and does the initial analysis. But basically, the bank is concerned about two things. One, the value of the collateral, which is why we only lend half the money, half the value. And then the second part is the ability to repay. So within those two parameters, and again, very quickly, if somebody has, hey, I want to buy this house or this condo or this property, and we know what it is, we look at it, we say, okay, well, it's worth, $500,000, we'll loan you $250,000, and say, okay, send us your tax returns, right? And they send the tax returns and we see that, okay, they can make a payment or whatever it is of, $2,000 a month. Then very quickly, a mortgage can be generated. But our folks are very, very adept at doing a quick analysis so nobody wastes time. Like that condo is not worth $500,000. It's only worth $200,000. Why would you ever pay $500 for it? Right. So and the bank is pretty direct about that, right? And so again, it's quick, it's efficient, but it's again value of property, ability to repay.
Thank you. What additional fees are there for buying a home abroad versus buying a home in your own country? I'm talking perhaps notaries, translations, extra taxes, inspections, lawyers, extra lawyers. Are there much more additional fees that perhaps most investors don't think about? And if so, what are those kind of like fees that property investors need to consider?
Yeah. Different countries have different types of taxation. For example, Belize has a transfer tax. And so when you purchase a property, you or the seller, sometimes you split it, that's a negotiating point, have to pay an 8% transfer tax, right? That's how Belize collects tax money on real estate. There's also ongoing property taxes, but those numbers are de minimis, right? They're just so silly, inexpensive, they don't count. Other countries have higher property taxes, but don't have a transfer tax, right? And so depending on the country, I would say that your legal fees are about the same. Your title inspection, if it's lawyers, sometimes the lawyers do the closing and don't do title, and sometimes vice versa. If you're borrowing, the mortgage rates are definitely higher in Latin America than they are in the US, Europe, Canada. So it's probably a little bit more expensive to buy overseas on that sort of that front end friction cost, right? The friction element, with the one variable being how much does the government charge if there's a tax involved, a transfer tax, right? And that number is all over the board. 8% is probably the highest, and that's Belize. The offset, Lily, is that your cost of acquisition is so much less. I mean, just for example, an oceanfront home in Nicaragua on the Pacific Ocean is $450,000. I mean, you'd be at 5 million, you'd be 10 times that amount in California, maybe 20 times that amount, maybe $10 million, right? For the same house in California. You might be two or three times that price in Mexico, Cabo San Lucas, for example, owning a Marriott on the water in the Caribbean, like an oceanfront Marriott residence at, $350, right? You'd be five times that number, say, maybe more than that in Florida, right? And so while the transaction friction costs are higher than they are in, say, the U.S. or Europe, the cost of acquisition generally, not always, but almost always, is so much lower that if you just look at those transaction costs, you go, well, I mean, on the whole, this is a great deal, right? This is a great deal on the whole. If I look just at transaction costs, yeah, they're higher, but you can't look at it that way. But they are higher. To answer your question, they are slightly higher to maybe moderately higher if there's a transfer tax involved.
Okay, tell us where property investors can connect with you.
You know what? We have set up a special email address so that when people come to me, right, we know they came from you, Lily. It's pws@ecidevelopment.com, pws@ecidevelopment.com. And then if you want a copy of my book, I will provide a free copy of my book. You can go on Amazon, you can download it. We will send you a link so that you can get a free copy of the book, because at the end of the day, we want everybody to get it right the first time. Right, we want everybody to get it right the first time, because if somebody gets it right, they're going to tell 10 people. Oh, I bought this house, I bought this condo, it's great. If they get it wrong, they're going to tell 110 people. Right, and so my professional mission is to get I want people to get it right for the first time so they have a great experience. But if you get it right, tell a lot of people you got it right, and if we can help more and more people do that, we'll be happy. That's how people get a hold of me. I'd love to send anybody who requests a copy of the book. It's a download. It's a Kindle on Amazon. That's my treat and my thank you to you, Lily, and your listeners.
Follow me for more property wealth strategies.